Shrink Wrap Radio number 609. Neurofeedback to improve focus with neuroscientist and entrepreneur Ariel Garten.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Ariel Garten, who is a psychotherapist, neuroscientist, entrepreneur, TED presenter, and developer of the Muse Brain Sensing Headband. For more information about Ariel Garten, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Ariel Garten, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. It's fantastic to be here.
Well, it's fantastic to have you here. You're the inventor of Muse, the brain sensing headband, which actually, thanks to you, I've got a demo model here just so that people on YouTube will see what it looks like. So easy on, easy off. And I've been enjoying using it for several weeks now. But before we get into that, maybe you can take us through your pre-Muse career, if you will. For example, where did you go to school? What did you major in? What did you see yourself doing down the line, etc.?
Sure. So my pre-Muse career probably starts way back in childhood. I was always fascinated with the world and how it worked and how we perceive and understand things. Okay. And I was also fascinated to make stuff, make physical stuff that allowed us to have experiences of the world. Mm-hmm. In high school, I excelled in sciences and I worked in research labs. And I also was the lead in the school play and was really, you know, fascinated by both the artistic side of the world, how we express ourselves as humans, and the scientific and technical side of the world, how stuff really works from a molecular level. I went to the University of Toronto as an undergrad, majored in neuroscience. Actually, there was no neuroscience program at that point, so it was a hybrid that I put together of biology and psychology. And then as I was graduating, they finally created a neuroscience program that I was able to fold into. And at the same time, ran an art gallery out of my home and had a clothing line that I sold to stores across North America and was always creating experiences. After university, I went on to open a clothing store and had a line that I sold across North America, and at the same time continued working in neuroscience research labs. I worked in neurogenesis and Parkinson's disease, and then ultimately began my training as a psychotherapist in Gestalt, CBT, and NLP. Trying to find ways to marry the way that we understand ourselves in the world and making tangible stuff that allows us to have experiences in it.
Yeah, what a perfect background for everything that you've done. For example, you were in plays, you were interested in drama, and in your career you've presented to huge crowds, evidently. You've done a lot of presenting, I gather, in your capacity as the head of the company. How do you say the company that makes Muse? I don't know how to say that word.
So our company name was Interaxon. We sat down and said, okay, we're going to create a company that is about interacting with the brain. We came up with a super nerdy name, Interaxon. Axons that communicate with one another. It's a double entendre to interaction.
Yeah. Oh, wonderful. Great. I'm big on double entendre, Shrink Wrap Radio, as you know.
So, I love it.
That was certainly one. So did you grow up in Canada as well? Are you Canadian?
I did. I grew up right in downtown Toronto. And in my background, my mom's an artist. So from her, I got this understanding that you can imagine anything you want and bring it to life. Wow. And my father's in real estate. So from him, I got the deep business background.
Yeah, really? Really? What a combo. And was the art that you were selling your own art or your mom's art or both?
It was both my art and lots of other Canadian artists. So I created gallery spaces where people could come and create and share. Because I was always really fascinated by how we turn a lens on ourselves and create experiences that help us understand what it is to be human, these funny edges that we have as humans.
Yeah. So part of your preparation for the work that you're doing now was that you did research in neuroscience, and you mentioned some of the subject areas. Are you continuing to do any research in your I gather you're on the board of InterAxon now. You had been CEO, and then I found an article that said you stepped down from that.
I stepped down when I got pregnant, so I stepped down for maternity leave, and somebody else very competent took my place as CEO. And my role now actually is evangelist. So I'm the chief evangelist, and I get to do what I absolutely love doing, which is teaching people about their brain and helping them fulfill the mission of really understanding that the place inside our head doesn't need to be a scary place, that the negative thoughts that we have, the negative experiences inside our own brain don't need to hold us back from being fully engaged in who we are and in our lives.
So how did you come to develop Muse? Are you the inventor of Muse, or how would you characterize your role in? I know you're the founder of InterAxon.
Yeah, so myself and my two co-founders, Chris and Trevor, began working in a research lab with Dr. Steve Mann in the early 2000s. I started to become very interested in brain waves as something that carried both real technical information about the self as well as a sort of noumenal artistic experience. So Steve Mann is one of the individuals who's credited as the father of wearable computing, and he had an early brain-computer interface that he'd built at MIT in the 90s. And in 2002, 2003, we started to create concerts where people could make music with their mind. So you'd have a single EEG lead on the back of your head, and by simply calming, you would increase your alpha waves, and we would use that as a signal to then start to change the world around you. And the first thing we did was we made concerts where 48 people at a time could modulate sound with their brain. Stood back from this and I said, oh my God, this is phenomenal. You know, not only are we able to have this really emotional experience of ourself, but we're literally also controlling and interacting with the world directly with our brain.
Yeah.
This is the first time we're able to put a window into the mind, so to speak, and actually have a direct connection with the brain that I never experienced with anything before.
Yeah.
And so that became the beginning of this journey to create Muse.
Yes. And you mentioned alpha. And I've wondered about the Muse device. Is that, you know, just so that our listeners and viewers have some understanding, there are some options as to the sound that you can be controlling, sound feedback that you can be controlling with your brain. And the one that I find I like best is the rainstorm and controlling the weather that way. And so I've wondered, is that indicating that when I am able to quiet the weather, am I in an alpha state, if you will?
So we no longer use the very simple band power approach to the brain. So back in the early 2000s, we were very simply looking at change in power of alpha or power of beta. And power of alpha indicating a focused relaxation, power of beta indicating a cognitively processing focus or cognitive activity. And so we created a range of installations based on that. But as we've become significantly more sophisticated in bringing Muse out to the world, Muse doesn't simply look at alpha, beta. It looks at a broad range of your own personal EEG characteristics. So we now have over 5 million sessions of meditation with Muse, and from that have created a very sophisticated algorithm that knows specifically when a user is in focused attention versus when their mind is wandering. So it takes into account all aspects of your brain activity at that moment. What's happening at the four different sensor points, there's two sensors frontal, two sensors temporal, what your existing data history looks like, and your full spectrum of EEG activity at the time.
So how can I know, if I'm from Missouri and I'm distrustful, how can I know that it's working, that it's measuring something real?
So lots of different ways. Okay. One, put it on and do the test for yourself. If you're focused on a single object like your breath, does it seem to quiet? When your mind wanders and you start to think about different things, you will hear the wind or the rain pick up. So in most cases, it works quite effectively. People's brains are complex, so it doesn't work 100% of the time, but it's a pretty darn good guide. And the second way is the vast body of research that's been done with Muse. So Muse is a, for those of you who aren't seeing the video or hearing, it's a four-channel EEG that just slips on very easily. And we have 200 different research institutions that use it in a wide variety of ways. Some of them are using our meditation application specifically, like the Mayo Clinic that uses it with breast cancer patients awaiting surgery. They're given a Muse 4 weeks prior to surgery and for 2 weeks after to demonstrate a decrease in the stress in the cancer care process. Other people are just taking it as a clinical grade EEG, and there have been lots of studies that have been done demonstrating its efficacy next to a gold standard EEG like a Biosemi or
Activision. That's amazing that for around $200 you can get a really capable EEG machine.
It's only four channels, with, you're losing a lot in the fidelity over the entire range of the head.
Right.
However, what you get in the trade-off is something that you can now use on dozens of people. I mean, we've had studies. Baycrest did a study with 500 participants in it over the course of a night, and we're able to find interesting characteristics in the EEG that have never been seen before because you can now do EEG neuroscience in situ, and you can do it across broad swaths of the population.
Well, tell us some of the interesting things that have emerged from that.
So in the Baycrest study that was published in PLOS One, they were able to see speed of learning effects. So they were able to see how quickly somebody could learn to modulate their EEG activity or modulate their focus. In a study that we published with McMaster University, we were able to look at about 5,000 samples from our data set and see the change in EEG over age. So alpha peak frequency is a fairly reliable marker of brain age. It's been demonstrated in a number of previously published papers, but nobody's actually been able to see the resolution of that change over time. And because we have, you know, hundreds of thousands of users, we're able to see literally decade by decade the decrement in alpha peak frequency. So you can see somebody in their 20s have an alpha frequency of, say, 10.5. I'm just picking a relatively random number, and it goes down decade by decade by decade till you're in your 70s, your 80s, and you're down at, you know, 7, 6 and change again.
That probably answers one of the questions. That probably speaks to one of the questions I was going to ask you was, I was feeling good about myself, thought I was doing really well, and then I put it on my 12-year-old granddaughter. And for a 10-minute session, and she had zero, I've forgotten the term you used.
Recoveries, maybe?
Yeah, zero recoveries. 100 birds. and birds, I have hearing issues, so I don't hear the birds. But she had 100 birds, zero recoveries, and something like 2,000 points, attention points.
Wow.
Which, yeah, it blew me away. It's like, okay, I'm not going to do this anymore, which is not a good meditative attitude.
It's not the goal. The goal is not to compare yourself with others. It's a personal journey.
Yeah. It's hard to, as a male, as a high achiever, it's hard to unhook from that achievement motivation. And I contacted your tech support people, in fact, and said, well, how come, you know, there's a graph that you can see of your session to see sort of where what your brain waves look like and a bit of interpretation. But I said, where's the graph over time so that I can see that I'm getting better? And they said, well, that doesn't exist because we're checking the we're setting the base. Your baseline is going to vary from session to session.
Exactly.
And so that's why. So was that the right information? I can't watch my personal growth over time?
So your brain is different every day. And in each session, you do a calibration that tests where your brain is at. So you're always looking at how that session was relative to where you came in. However, over time, people do see a significant improvement. Mm-hmm. So for anybody who's never used Muse before, we should maybe back up for a moment and describe the experience of using Muse. So you slip on the headband and you're actually getting real-time feedback on your meditation. So you know when you're in focused attention and when your mind is wandering. And the metaphor we use is your mind is like the weather. So when you're thinking, distracted, your brain's bouncing all over the place, you hear it as stormy or rainy. And as you come to quiet, focused attention, you then quiet those winds or rains or storm.
Okay.
So it's a really easy feedback experience. Am I wandering? Can I bring it back? After your meditation, you also get a graph that shows you what your brain was doing at every moment in your meditation. And you get something called birds. So if you're super focused, if you're able to maintain that focus for a period of time, you hear a little bird tweet on your shoulder.
Wouldn't the birds be distracting and pull you out of that state?
That's part of it. So birds are actually there in some way to undermine the reward architecture. So there's a motivational architecture that goes along with this where you get points and rewards to encourage you and keep you moving forward for those like you who are motivated by succeeding. But this goal-oriented architecture is also a little bit antithetical to the goal of meditation, which is to let go of all of this.
Yeah.
So over time, you move from this extrinsic reward to the intrinsic reward of what am I experiencing? I'm feeling better. I like doing this for me, not for the reward. And we have birds there as a thing that shows you. So you're like, I'm doing great. I get a bird. And then as soon as you get excited that you have a bird, the bird flies away.
Yeah, right.
And so you learn to be equally as equanimous about your rewards as you do your failures.
Okay, I understand that. Now, just to fill out the picture a little bit more, the way that the person is getting this feedback is through a smartphone. In my case, it's the iPhone. Does it also work with Android phones?
It certainly does. So it works on iPhone and all newer Android devices.
Okay. So I'm hearing this auditory feedback that we've been talking about is coming from my iPhone.
Yes.
And I do it with the earbuds, AirPods that I'm wearing right now. Whatever they're called, AirPods.
AirPods, yes.
AirPods, yeah. And but also I discovered with my granddaughter, we were having trouble hooking it up with the AirPods, and they kept falling out of her ears. And so I discovered accidentally that, oh, you don't need to have any kind of headphones on. You just let it play through the speaker, and that worked fine. And
absolutely.
And that way I could kind of share in her experience, because since I was in the room, I could kind of hear how she was doing. So that was interesting to me.
Now, those are some of the most beautiful experiences I've had when you can just turn on the volume and literally be inside somebody's mind and hear where they're focused and hear where they're wandering.
Yeah.
And, you know, as a therapist, and as a parent or a grandparent, you try to get closer and closer to those people around you. And this is this amazing, beautiful metaphor for literally being inside their own mind.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a nice way to think about it. You're a mother. Have you used these with your children?
My little boy just turned 2.
Oh, so it's a little early still.
Yeah, he's too small to fit the headband on.
Okay,
Typically, people start using it with their kids around 6 or 7, depending on the size of the head. We say that it fits from age 13 and up, but people have often had success with younger children fitting it as well.
Okay. Yeah, the headband is somewhat adjustable, I discovered. Yeah. So, but it worked on our 12-year-old, but we couldn't get it all to work on the 10-year-old. So,
a little more frontal lobe development, and she's going to be there. He or she will be there soon.
Yeah. I assume you've done some testing, in all the research that you have tested it with longtime meditators to see how it compares with their experience of meditation. Do they find that it takes them to the same place as it, or what?
So the device is used broadly both by novices, people who've never meditated before, to learn how to meditate, and by experts who use it depending on how they feel in their practice. Some people use it just to track their meditation. Other people use it, if you have an expert meditator for the first time putting it on, they're usually quite amazed to get this real-time feedback and have a new lens with which to see their own mind. As meditators, we're consciousness explorers, always discovering new ways to understand our attention and hone that.
Yeah.
Some people will do it for like a 5-minute meditation prior to another type of meditation that they like in order to get themselves right into the zone.
Mm-hmm.
It is important to note that the algorithm was built specifically with focused attention on the breath. So it doesn't work with other meditation, it won't work with walking meditation, for example. It works in scenarios where somebody's seated, focusing on a specific object.
Yes, and that's always been my meditation of preference, is the following of the breath. So that certainly works for me. I wondered if it I was thinking, well, maybe I should think of this as training wheels for becoming a meditator, for learning to meditate. And in my own case, I've been an off and on meditator over the course of my life. And it's motivating. It's like I feel motivated to use this. So it's, you know, it's having that good effect for me.
That's fantastic. And that's actually a metaphor, the idea of training wheels that we use here too. So if you've never had a practice before, this really teaches you what to do. For all of us who either ourselves or our clients are like, what's meditation? How do I do it? This really shows you what you're supposed to do. And for those people who have an on-again, off-again practice, this is like, it's like training wheels, or it's like a coach holding your hand and being there with you to guide you and encourage you and give you reminders and feedback and motivation. We also now have a news community. So we have a Facebook group of thousands of people who you can share your data and experiences with, and they'll talk about their meditation, and everybody will talk about their meditation experience with or without Muse, and that really keeps you engaged and on the wagon meditating. So it's both, you know, the training wheels and the thing that keeps you on the wagon.
Yeah, okay. And I should mention, too, that I discovered this a little late. I missed it in the beginning, is that there are different programs that you can select. And that one of them is Deepak Chopra. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And it made me wonder, I wonder if that's a direction. I was talking to a friend about the product, and he mentioned something like that. Well, are there other points of view or other, you know, points of view or approaches to meditation? And so that could be a line extension for you guys. And I just wonder, do you plan to go more in that direction? I think right now there are two different, there was Deepak and there was two people from another meditation company, if we can say that.
Yeah, there's the Levies, who are amazing, Joel and Michelle Levy meditation teachers who are filled with heart, and Deepak. And yes, again, you hit it right on the nose. We actually just merged with another company called Meditation Studio that has a very popular app filled with 500 different meditations. Mm-hmm. And so soon you're going to be seeing their teachers bringing content into the Muse ecosystem. So we have the core experience where you can hear your mind during meditation and get the real-time feedback. And then we'll also have a range of different meditations for sleep, anxiety, stress, et cetera, to guide you and encourage you through your day with or without the Muse.
Ah, that'll be very interesting to see. So you're going to need to kind of tweak the algorithm, so to speak, for different kinds of experiences, right?
Yeah, you're going to see a range of new experiences coming out with Muse for the next while. Yeah.
Will there be any way to upgrade an existing Muse unit with a different algorithm?
So luckily, algorithms are all software experiences. So with the existing Muse, you'll be able to get new experiences too.
There'll be a way to download and get those into it. Okay.
Because the Muse is really a platform for a range of different meditation experiences, with meditation in the self, meditation in the body, meditation in the mind.
Yeah, interesting. I think sleep is certainly a huge issue for many people. And to have a natural, you know, a non-drug sleep aid would be very useful.
One of the most common things I actually hear is that people sleep significantly better after they're musing.
Yeah.
And sometimes it'll happen where, you know, in a couple, maybe the wife will buy a Muse and it'll sit by the bedside, and gradually she'll notice every night it's on the husband's side of the bed because he's using it to fall asleep every night.
Yeah. Although I've noticed that it feels like it's impacted my dreaming, and it's hard to describe that. I go to sleep easily. Anyway.
Hallelujah.
But, yeah, really.
You're very blessed. Glad
for that, right? And but I felt like there was a a different kind of depthful experience in some of my dreams, where I felt there was some kind of underlying wisdom or conversations that I was having with dream figures. I felt a kind of, dare I say, spiritual authority in my dream self in these dialogues. So
that is fascinating. I can't say in any way that that's from the muse, but that's, you know, certainly from your experience of using the muse. So whether you felt like you were more spiritual and connected because of it, or had tapped into a new part of yourself now that you've achieved a daily practice, whatever it is, it's a beautiful experience to have.
Yeah, I felt so. I got very, I don't know if you've read Michael Pollan's book on psychedelics, How to Change Your Mind. Have you encountered that book?
I have not, but I know a lot of his body of work. Yeah. What are the ideas that resonated there with you?
Well, I've had a long-standing interest in altered states of consciousness. Generally, mm-hmm. Some of my doctoral work was on that, and actually my doctoral dissertation was on meditation, believe it or not, back in 1970.
Oh, amazing. I want to hear more about that.
I have to remember. It's been so long ago. I was studying the role of attention in mm-hmm. meditation and hypnosis. And, of course, didn't have these tools. I didn't have any technological tools. So I had people in a soundproof chamber, in one case following their breath, in another condition of staring at a candle. And they were I had a mechanical button hooked up to a counter in another room for them to press every time they had an intrusion or brought themselves back. I don't know for sure how robust a measure that was, kind of primitive, but I heard from one of my own graduate students who had visited Harvard, and he mentioned, he was asking what they were doing, and they said, oh, we're using the Van Nuys technique. So somebody at Harvard was using
this. Wow.
I was pretty flattered, you know, because I was fresh out of graduate school at that point. So I have a long-standing interest in this. Would you say that muse leads to altered states of consciousness?
That's, you know, certainly not a claim that we make, and it's certainly not validated by any research. And, you know, as the scientist, I have to lay out all that groundwork. However, you know, somebody who's beginning a meditation practice or somebody has an interest in meditation and altered states, essentially what you're doing is learning how to manage your internal state of mind and access new parts of yourself. And the way that you do that is through mental training. The way that you do that is through changing the relationship between your thoughts. The way that you do that is through being able to maintain your attention for significant periods of time.
Right.
And, yeah. Generally, reported from monks and others that when you sit in silence with your own mind for long periods of time, these altered states begin to arise and the self begins to drop away. To get there takes a hell of a lot of training, and this is certainly one of the tools in the training kit.
Yeah, yeah. You asked me about Michael Pollan's book. This mm-hmm. book is about psychedelics. I thought I was pretty knowledgeable about that, having come through the 60s and experimented mm-hmm. a lot with psychedelics. Somehow still made it through through a graduate education. And so I thought I knew a lot about that, but I learned so much from his book, because he came to it as somewhat of a skeptic, as an open-minded skeptic, but kind of admitted that basically he's a materialist and not especially spiritual and so on. So he came at it both intellectually, but then he ends up in the course of events deciding that he's got to get involved experientially with this, and he shares the experiences that he had, and he interviews many of the leading lights and movers and shakers around all of that, and there's a renaissance of research now.
Yes.
That's happening around psychedelics, and he covers a lot of that. So one of the things that he talks about is some research that by a Brit by the name of Robin Carhart-Harris on the default mode network. mm-hmm. of the brain. And I had recently learned about that network from another neuroscience interview that I did. And this is just a hypothesis by Paulin and Carhart-Harris, is that if we can quiet the default mode network, which is, this is sort of the, like when the car is idling, and mm-hmm. so when the brain is sort of in idling mode, it's not inactive, but in fact it's, and I'm sure you know this, it's very active, a lot of activity going on. But it may be that the speculation was that some of these psychedelic states of transcendence may involve a quieting of that network. And there's some sort of corollary evidence to suggest that that could be the case.
That's really interesting. Certainly with long-term meditators, you see a decrease in the default mode network. And that's the work of Dr. Judson Brewer. You put an average individual inside an MRI machine and you see activation of the DFM. So that's the area between your frontal cortex and your PCC. Posterior cingulate cortex, you see that network lit up significantly, and it correlates to this internal dialogue that we have, the voice that's always going on inside our heads.
Right.
And, you know, sort of meditation mythos, we talk about the monkey mind and the chatter of the monkey mind, and it turns out that it's a real neurophysiological phenomenon. When you put a long-term meditator inside an MRI and tell them to just lie there and do nothing, they, A, don't have that monkey mind reported, the internal chatter, and B, you don't see activity, significant activity in their default mode network. It quiets down. So it's certainly a finding from standard meditation. I wonder if you put somebody in a, you know, in psilocybin or any of the other psychoactives in an MRI, what their DFM is doing.
Well, that's going to be studied. It probably is being studied. Even
you're somewhere in a lab right now.
Yeah, really. And it might be that one of the algorithms that you would develop would have something to do with that, with quieting that, or maybe that is what's happening now. I'm not sure. And it's interesting that just this morning I was thinking about the monkey mind. I must have been thinking about this coming up. And I was thinking monkey mind, and I was thinking, well, that, you know, we have these three different layers of the brain, if you will, and a monkey mind would maybe suggest a more archaic layer. So I thought that'd be interesting if, you know, in the Far East they somehow came up with this metaphor that in fact is an accurate description of our brain organization. So that's me going out on a limb.
Leads to the question, do monkeys have monkey mind? Do monkeys have chatter inside their DFM, default mode network? And I would guess the answer is no, because that internal chatter is a reflection of the self. It's essentially, it's the ego talking, it's the self, it's the internal voice that we hear. And as far as we know, lower primates don't have a sense of self and don't have an internal dialogue. Indeed, it requires language to have an internal dialogue.
Interesting.
Do monkeys have a monkey mind? Probably not. Potentially.
I would have said
yes.
That's
one for the primate consciousness researchers to...
Since they're swinging from the trees all the time, I figure their brain's going to be similar in that regard.
But do they have a self do they have a self that is constantly critiquing, dialoguing, planning, chattering in their own ears?
I don't know. We do have the gorillas and some of the other apes that have been taught sign language and so mm-hmm. on, and have been shown to have some rudimentary sense of self. So there might be some champion primates out there that have this capability. So I meant to ask you, what plans do you have for Muse going forward? And you've already alluded to some of those directions. Are there any others that come to mind?
Sure. So we have a program that we use Muse with psychotherapists, psychiatrists, life coaches, and it's called Muse Connect, and that allows you to use it inside of your clinical practice. So in the past, I was a therapist for almost a decade, and I try to teach my patients and clients meditation, and typically you try to explain it, they go home, they don't necessarily do it, and then it becomes a somewhat frustrating loop. Now you can simply hand your patient a Muse or use it in session with them, explain the meditation process, actually have them hear and feel in real time what their mind is doing during meditation, and then prescribe the use of it regularly throughout the week. You can actually track each of your clients and how their meditation is going. And when they come back, you can actually look at the data together with them and have an object for their experience that you can talk about together. You can actually look, say like, hey, you know, what was your brain doing at that moment? How was your experience this day? You know, what notes do you have alongside it? So it becomes this really tangible way to bring meditation into a clinical practice or coaching practice.
Yeah. Yeah. Going back to the idea of controlling external reality with external things with the brain, there's been quite a bit of that actually by now with for rehabilitation, right, with people who've lost function in their body, maybe people who are quadriplegics, the controlling of robotic limbs and robots themselves. There are certainly a lot of games in which that's one of the electronic video games in which that's one of the principles. Where do you think all of this is going to go?
So we're very early on in the stages of controlling stuff with our mind.
Yeah.
Actually, in our history of developing this, we tried all of those things. We made games that you control with your brain. We let people light up tall buildings with their mind, all of which showed us the fact that the most valuable thing that we can do with this technology now is help us turn the lens inside and use it to understand ourselves. Ultimately, we are in a world of sensors, and sensors are going to get better and better at understanding ourselves and our needs and supporting our interaction with technology. We're a long way off till we can effectively control something with our brain, like a significantly long way off. But in the time from now until then, we will have technology that is able to understand some aspects of ourselves or our emotional experience and then be able to reflect that back to us so that we can get better and better at making choices about our lives.
One of the hats that I wear is that of a market researcher, and one of the developments that's happening now in the area of market research is the ability to kind of read what's going on in people's brains in response to advertising. That marketers are wanting to use these tools. And God, there was one I was reading about. Oh, there's somebody who gave a TED Talk, as you gave a TED Talk. There's a recent TED Talk where the woman was presenting Poppy somebody. Maybe you know who I'm referring to. Her first name, I think, was Poppy.
Okay, I don't know the TED Talk. She just spoke at the last TED?
Could be. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I didn't. I was at TED. I didn't see her talk, though. But yeah.
Oh. They were able to make judgments about emotional arousal and involvement based on the air that our breath is revealing of our emotional states, of our internal states. So that's one way. Pupil dilation is another way.
Yeah.
So I think the pupil dilation and so on is one of the things that's being used in market research, where you'll be watching a video of an ad, and there are points where you're very absorbed and that's highlighted, and they're doing heat maps, all kinds of things. What are your thoughts about that? I sometimes wonder about the ethics of all of that.
Yeah, so you got right to the heart of the matter. So for me, I am not in favor of using this for market research. I'm really not in favor of technology understanding people better so they can sell crap that we don't need more efficiently. To me, that is not, you know, supporting to the growth and flourishment of our human experience. I am in favor of using this information insofar as it gives us better experiences about ourselves. So we're notoriously bad at really understanding our own emotional states. We're notoriously bad at noticing when we're slipping into depression. We're notoriously bad at knowing exactly what triggered the anger that we feel now, and so we blame the person in front of us as opposed to the actual experience. And so using technology as a mechanism to heighten and highlight those aspects of ourselves and interactions with the world that are meaningful to us, that allow us to understand ourselves better and make better decisions about ourselves, to me is really key. And to do that, we need technology that is focused on enhancing ourselves as humans, not simply trying to take up space in the marketplace or sell us stuff.
Well said. I think, too, I'm suspicious of some of, I think people will make claims for the efficacy of, you know, for selling products and so on, that I think are not necessarily supported by the science. You know, it's sort of like the Wizard of Oz. We've got flashing lights and interesting sounds.
Yeah, we've got flashing lights and we'd like to raise some money. It can do this.
That's why
we're extremely cautious about what we say it can do. Can it help you achieve altered states? I don't know. We haven't done the research study on that.
We
have, I'll let you know. It has been correlated with this or that, however. I think it's...
You do market it as helping concentration, and I know there was some work with kids who have ADD. Is there any sort of more generalized research about its usefulness for somebody who, for students who study, for example?
So meditation overall, so Muse is something that helps you meditate, and that has been clearly demonstrated through research studies. Meditation overall is something that has been demonstrated many, many times over to help improve your attention and decrease your stress, to help kids study for the GREs and on and on, to improve your productivity at work, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. With Muse and students, we specifically have one study that from Kansas State University, and it looked at grade 8 students, not their concentration, but their behavior. And it showed that kids who meditated with Muse showed a 72% decrease in being sent to the principal's office. So that was a beautiful study.
You know, I also thought about the Apple Watch. The Apple Watch has made, and I've got one, the Apple Watch, they're doing research that it's not fully realized yet in terms of monitoring physiological states that has that have bearing on our health. And so what do you think about that? And is there a way in which the Apple Watch could work in concert with the Muse, do you think?
Sure. The Apple Watch gives you your heart rate, and HRV is a really meaningful way to understand your level of stress and your ability to relax your body. So adding an HRV experience, having your smartphone disappear and doing your Muse session directly on your Apple Watch, and we're going to see more and more convergence of sensors. And as we get better at converging sensors and data and having a better picture of what happens to our bodies and all these different experiences, what our physiology is like during experience, we can get better and better at using that information to help us.
What in neuroscience and this sort of range that we've been talking about in terms of monitoring the interstates and all, what's on the horizon that has you excited? What are you excited about these days?
Oh, that's my foot's falling asleep. I'm excited. My foot is slightly asleep for a second. Sorry. So there's a lot of exciting things happening in neuroscience. One is smaller and smaller sensors. And so they have even, out of UC San Diego, tattoo-like sensors on your forehead. The ability to actually map the connectome. It's going to be a long time coming, but the map of every connection in the brain and what it could mean is extraordinarily exciting. We have only very rudimentary maps of the brain, and we have an idea of what happens, you know, in each area, but each area is responsible for so many different functions, and everybody's brain is uniquely different. And so, you know, the ability to build better and better maps and then have that data be meaningful in some way. So things like taking an MRI and then being able to layer on top of it, e.g. real-time data, so that you can both see what's happening in the structure and then what's happening in the electrical connections at any moment in time, is going to give us more and more precise ideas about how the brain works during a range of different activities. And actually, friends of mine, Tim Mullen and his crew, built something called the glass brain, which already they take a DTI. So DTI is diffusion tensor imaging. It's an MRI with another layer on it that lets you look at the tractography, the connections, the tracks in your brain. And then they layer on it real-time EEG. And you can, and then they put it in a VR environment. And so you can literally fly through somebody's brain in VR, watching the electrical interactions through their physiological structure and connections. So they don't have a lot of meaning associated with it. Right now, it's a methodology that looks cool. Over time, we're going to have better and better resolution to understand what's happening moment by moment in the brain using technologies like that.
Do you see VR, any VR, in the future of Muse that would help to, you know, I don't know, in a way that's sort of taking one out of one's inner world, right? And so maybe it's a contradiction.
So we do actually have a lot of people who use Muse with VR simultaneously. So as it is, you can slip on a Muse headband with an Oculus VR or a Samsung Gear. And we've even made a faceplate that allows you to readily do that. So in the existing Muse experience, you know, you're feeling like you're inside your own head when you hear it in your own mind. But there's a lot of interest in people who want to do therapy in virtual worlds, who want to do PTSD therapy and have a visual virtual world experience in real time with your EEG. So it's something that we've collaborated with others on and have our own technology here to do as well.
Artificial intelligence is another exciting area and also a buzzword. I think there are going to be more and more products out there, like toothpaste, you know, with new X47 added. And I think there are going to be a lot of claims for artificial intelligence. We have artificial intelligence stirred in with deep learning.
Yeah.
Do you see artificial intelligence? Is AI employed in the development of this product, your product, or
absolutely? So we've been using deep learning, actual deep learning, for years now. We came out of a tradition out of the University of Toronto that was started by Jeff Hinton, who's the guy who invented the term deep learning. So we're just lucky to have been in this physical space with the inventors of that AI methodology. So for us, you know, we look at millions and millions of sessions of EEG data and have to pull meaning out of that vast amount of noise and then use that meaning to reproduce an experience in somebody else to understand if they're focused or if their mind is wandering, and then to, over time, bring in other sensor data. So, you know, AI is key to what we do. And that's, maybe it becomes safer. You know, AI can sound scary. Machine learning is also basically a corollary phrase for AI. There's the joke in Silicon Valley, it's AI when you're pitching for money and machine learning when you're hiring talent. So machine learning helps you understand from these vast data sets what's actually going on with these, you know, complex ideas with more data than any human being could possibly understand at once. And to simplify it down to really simple experiences.
That makes a lot of sense.
It requires many humans in the loop to interpret it and really make it meaningful and useful.
Yeah, interesting. Well, we've sort of done it. Is there anything more that you would like our listeners and viewers to know?
Well, if you want, we can delve more into what happens in the brain during meditation. You can ask me anything about meditation.
No.
Okay. All right. We don't need to know about more brains. Perfect.
Yeah. Well, I take it you are a meditator? You're a regular meditator? And do you still use the Muse or not?
Absolutely.
Really?
You can't not use the Muse. For me, it's not something I use all the time. You know, meditation, once you become a long-term meditator, meditation becomes something that happens throughout the course of your day. So meditation is the training. Mindfulness is the skill that is built through meditation. And mindfulness is hopefully something that you bring into every moment of your life thereafter. But I use Muse as a regular practice, as a thing that helps me, you know, maintain my meditation. And I'll do other forms of meditation throughout the day. But musing regularly is always what I come back to.
Okay. Well, Ariel Garten, I really want to thank you for sharing so much with us today. And it's been great speaking with you.
My absolute pleasure. Awesome to hear from you, to learn more about your background and your experience, and to be able to share with everybody else.
Okay, well, thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks for having me.
I must say, I'm very impressed by Ariel Garten. She has such a varied background in art, design, clothing, and then add to that her studies in neuroscience. And she's created successful businesses in all of these categories. She truly is a born entrepreneur. Right up until our interview, I had assumed that she has a PhD in neuroscience. She hastened to correct me, though, when I initially addressed her as Dr. Ariel Garten. My guess is that she could have easily completed a doctoral program, but got hijacked by success, which has to be one of the better reasons for dropping out of school. By whatever means, it's very clear that she managed to get a lot of neuroscience under her belt, including research experience in that domain. Also, it became clear that her dedication to the creation and marketing of Muse is not solely about making money. Her personal commitment to meditation and the exploration of her own inner world was evident throughout our discussion. I'm impressed by the degree to which her ethical commitments manifested in our interview as well. I think all of these background experiences and personal qualities have found physical expression in the Muse brain scanning headband. As you heard, I've been using the device for the past 3 or 4 weeks, and I'm very impressed by the quality of both the hardware and the software. They show the kind of care and attention to detail that I associate with Apple products. And with all that success that our company, Interaxon, has enjoyed, they are not resting on their laurels. They're partnering not only with Deepak Chopra for guided meditations, but also with another company that will bring their own catalog of 500 guided meditation scripts to the product offering. And I was especially impressed to hear that they have plans to upgrade the hardware as they move forward, presumably through firmware, I'm guessing. This will allow them to add new protocols for real-time analysis of brainwave data for specific applications. It will be exciting to see what emerges over time. I'm also impressed to see that they are supporting psychotherapists and other sorts of clinicians as well as researchers. If you go to their website at choosemuse.com, you'll see they offer support packages for clinicians and for researchers. Speaking of research, on their site, they have links to 9 of their many published research studies. I do have some background training and experience in biofeedback, and I have to say how impressed I am by this very affordable, sophisticated neurofeedback device that provides 4 channels of brainwave information. If it sounds like I'm in sales mode here, I guess I am. When I approached Ariel Garten for this interview, it was not with that idea. But I've been able to obtain an affiliate relationship with them that allows me to offer you a 15% discount along with a money-back guarantee. Your purchase will also add a small amount to Shrink Wrap Radio. If you'd like to take advantage of this opportunity, click on the Muse banner ad in the left-hand sidebar at shrinkwrapradio.com, and that will take you directly to their site. And if you decide to order from there, our 15% discount code will be added automatically to your order.
Hi, Dave. It's Heiko from Germany. I work in a violence counseling center as a psychologist and psychotherapist in Düsseldorf. And I graduated from university more than 20 years ago. So I'm always on the lookout for new perspectives and new developments in psychotherapy and psychology. And so I discovered your Wise Counsel podcasts several years ago. And it made me feel like I was sitting in the lecture hall in university again, and I liked it very much. I decided to follow your Shrink Wrap Radio podcast, and when a topic comes along that seems of interest to me, like recently Dr. Rumanier on deliberate practice, I listen to it, and mostly I very much enjoy it. And so I think it's only decent, if I like it, that I contribute to the cost and reward your efforts you have with it. You offer this guilt-free option. It's only $12 a year. I mean, it's almost nothing. So I decided to rid myself of my guilt and be decent and pay something for the enjoyment you give me with your podcasts. Thank you very much for your efforts, and I hope you will keep them coming.
Thank you, Heiko from Dusseldorf. I'm so glad to hear that you've found first my Wise Counsel podcast and later Shrink Wrap Radio to be helpful in your work as a psychologist there. I sure hope others will follow your example and get off the fence by becoming regular donors. On the last episode, I gave a shout out for a volunteer with some Instagram experience and expertise to step forward and help to promote Shrink Wrap Radio on that platform. Well, I'm happy to report that my plea did not fall on deaf ears. A wonderful volunteer has answered the call. I love the email she sent and have her permission to share it with you. Here's what she wrote. My name is Donna Mitchell, and I am an online psychologist. I was just listening to your podcast when I heard you mention that you're looking for a volunteer to head your Instagram account. I have just moved from South Africa to London, where I'm starting up my online therapy practice. To get more traffic to my website, I have also just begun an Instagram account. I'm getting a surprising amount of joy from creating the images that I use on my account at talkfeelchange.com. Now, that's also her website address, and she's got a beautiful website, so I encourage you to give it a visit. And she goes on to say, and I was wondering whether you would like me to do similar work for your account. I imagine what I would be doing would be listening to your newest podcast, learning a bit about whoever it is that you're interviewing, and then posting a picture reflective of the interview/discussion with a short description and relevant hashtags. Is this correct? Do you already have an Instagram account? Or would I be starting one up for you? If there's anything else that you would like me to do, I'm always happy to learn. After completing my master's in South Africa, I took some time off therapy and taught English for 3 years in Asia. I started in Thailand, then moved to South Korea, and finally taught in China. During this time, I began to feel dislocated from my therapist self, and listening to your podcast really helped me to feel like a member of the psychology community again. In fact, if it wasn't for your interview with Clay Cockerell, I don't think I would have been open to online therapy at all. I had no idea how closed-minded I was to the idea of online therapy until you explored this topic in depth with Clay. The impact that you and your podcast have had on my life has been remarkable, and I would really love the chance to pay it forward by helping out with your Instagram account. Please let me know what you need me to do for your account, and I'll get right on it. All the best, Donna Mitchell. Well, boy, that really gave me a shot of adrenaline. That was such a wonderful email to receive, to hear about Donna's wonderful background, and to get that kind of energy working to help promote Shrink Wrap Radio would be really great. And she also, in a follow-up email, suggested that I let you all know that the Shrink Wrap Radio Instagram account is shrinkwrap_radio, all lowercase. So you can use that in Instagram to get to our account there and see what we're posting, what we posted in the past, and hopefully to flood us with a bunch of likes. I think that's what helps to promote. That's why I need a volunteer who's more expert than I am, because I've never really gotten that deeply into Instagram, but I know many people are. So with that, I'm going to wrap it up for today, and I want to thank today's guest, Arielle Garten, for sharing her experience as an entrepreneur and founder of the Muse Braid Scanning Headband, and so much more. At the moment, I don't have a guest lined up next week or for the following week. I might scare one up. I've had some people who had changes of schedule, or I might take a break. I've been pretty consistent doing it each and every week for 13 years or more, so a little break might be in order. But at any rate, until we meet again, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.